Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk, and we are coming to you from a place that Democrats and locals hope will become the nation's 51st state, and that place is Washington, District of Columbia. In recent months, Democrats have been stepping up their push to make D.C. a state. They've introduced statehood bills in both the House and Senate, and next month, the House will have its first hearing on the issue in 26 years. Passage in the House with Democratic votes seems relatively straightforward, but a 60-vote majority in the Senate is another story. Statehood for D.C. is also one of several structural changes that some Democrats say would make it easier for the party to enact its agenda on the federal level. So that's what we're going to talk about today, why Democrats want D.C. to be a state, and how they plan to make it happen. And here with me to do that are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver, of course. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Hey, Galen.
And we also have a couple guests with us today. We have Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, the non-voting delegate to the House of Representatives from Washington, D.C. Hello and welcome.
And I don't like being called non-voting delegate because I do vote on some matters, even on the House floor, and I vote in committee. So I would prefer to be called either delegate or congresswoman, if you please.
Well, I will absolutely do that. And I'm sure that part of the reason you are here today is because you would like to be able to vote on a whole lot more. Also here with us today is the House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, a representative from Maryland. Hello and welcome.
Good to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Welcome back. In fact, you've been on the podcast before. And I'll also mention that today is part of our 538 on the Road series sponsored by WeWork. And I should clarify that we are actually on the road. I encounter plenty of people who think that we're based in D.C. We are not. We're based in New York. We just talk about what happens in D.C. all the time. But anyway, Congresswoman Norton, let's begin with you. You have been representing D.C. in Congress for almost three decades now. Why should it be a state?
Well, it should have been a state long ago. Its qualifications to be a state exceed those of most states. For example, the district is number one per capita in federal taxes paid to support the United States of America. The district is one of the oldest jurisdictions in the United States, and it has 700,000 Americans, and that's about the equivalent population of six states. So the real question is, why shouldn't D.C. be a state?
Well, I guess one of the answers to that is that the Constitution says that the seat of government should not be a state.
It says no such thing, and we needn't get into constitutional law. And you're talking to a former tenured professor of law at Georgetown. So that's not what it says. And every state that has entered the union did so the same way we're trying to get into the union, by vote of the states.
Can you walk us through, in 90 seconds or less, the constitutional argument, though? Because it is important for our listeners to hear.
The constitutional argument in favor of entry into the state. The way in which states get into the union is that there needs to be a vote. The states need to come together the way we do in passage of legislation.
From what I understand, though, the way that D.C. would gain statehood is by shrinking the actual seat of government to, like, the perimeter of some federal buildings, essentially leaving a seat of government that is not a state in order to satisfy that constitutional requirement, while making the vast majority of the district where most people live the actual state. Meaning that you wouldn't have to make a constitutional amendment in any way to satisfy, you know, the seat of government not being a state. Is that correct?
And that's what H.R. 51 does. I hope you get what 51 stands for.
I don't know. Could you spell it out for me?
But that's what H.R. 51 does. We leave the seat of government the seat of government.
Do they still get three electoral votes then?
That's going to have to be dealt with.
The White House, the Supreme Court, Congress.
So it's just like three votes for the incumbent party, basically? Or like, I guess people who work, who would it literally be?
We think that will be no problem getting Congress to vote to take away those three votes.
All right. Well, Congressman Hoyer, you actually opposed statehood for D.C. for many years, and you changed your position on the issue last week. You came out with an op-ed saying that you now support statehood for D.C.
Well, I think it'd be really incorrect. I know that's been said that I've opposed statehood. What I have done is support for decades, working hand in hand with Eleanor Holmes Norton. She's been the leader on this effort. I didn't oppose statehood. What I promoted, what I supported, what I thought was the right thing to do is to make sure that the 700,000 people who live in the District of Columbia all American citizens, like every other American citizen, had a voting representative in the Congress of the United States. Now, I've been sympathetic to the statehood in this sense that the residents of the District of Columbia want to be full American citizens, as they are, but they don't have a vote. And so they've been forced statehood. And I have come to conclude that they were right, that from a political standpoint, the best way to get that representation in the Congress is to become a state, because we found it so difficult, because people make this argument, well, they were supposed to be a separate and, you know, part of the country, but not a state, not a full partner. But James Madison said, one of the founding fathers, that the residents of the District of Columbia would have control over their own interests and be full citizens. Well, if they're full citizens, that means they've got Eleanor Holmes Norton as a full voting member. And I've come to the conclusion that the only way you're going to get there is to support the District of Columbia being a state, which, as Eleanor just pointed out, Congresswoman Norton just pointed out, has more population than a number of states.
And just to clarify for listeners, the pathway that you were looking towards previously was granting congressional representation to D.C. while still being a district and not a full state.
I think the proper way to say it, though, is not granting it to the district, the federal district, granting it to the 700,000 citizens of America a vote in their parliament. I frankly have not found in the free world the residents of a capital city that did not have a vote in their parliament, except for America. And that's a blot, I think, on our full democracy.
All right. So now the push is to make D.C. a full state. And as I mentioned, this has ramped up recently. I'm curious, Nate, what is the appetite amongst Americans for expanding statehood?
So it depends on which state you're talking about, which potential 51st state. In the case of D.C., the answer is ambivalent, I think, maybe shading a little skeptical. Although it's one of those cases where you don't have a lot of high-quality recent polling. The most recent poll of any kind we could find was from a group called Data for Progress, which is a liberal group, and we don't tend to love to cite partisan polls, which does not say they don't do good work, but it is the most recent poll by a few years. That shows the plurality actually has no opinion. About 37% has no opinion, 33% or so support, and 28% or so oppose. So it is an issue where I think perceptions are not all that dug in. There's some earlier polling, so Rasmussen, which is not technically
a partisan poll.
They aren't technically a partisan pollster. They are a lot more skewed than a lot of pollsters that are partisan. They found
towards
in 2000
the Republicans.
Toward the Republicans, yeah. It's
our listeners know that.
President Trump's favorite pollster. They found in 2013, 25% of Americans in favor, 44% opposed, again with a big don't know group. And then YouGov, which is an online pollster, they found actually fairly similar numbers to Rasmussen in 2014. On Puerto Rico, the numbers are a bit more in favor of statehood, although, again, fairly ambivalent. So Fox News, and I guess since we're qualifying every poll, Fox News, people have various opinions about whether Fox News is a partisan organization or not. Their polling tends to be fairly high quality and fairly nonpartisan. They found about Puerto Rico that I think about a plurality actually favored statehood, but not a majority. I think about 30% were opposed, and then some people actually say it should be an independent country. It's a minority opinion among U.S. residents. And support
and
Puerto Rico statehood. Well, and Puerto Ricans. I mean, there's also we could talk about referendums on Puerto Rico later on. But yeah, those numbers shifted after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. And so I would think as an outside observer, that's part of what's touching off the conversation, is that you see more support for Puerto Rico statehood, that there are disadvantages conveyed to it by being a commonwealth. And so, you know, to me, it's a debate. I guess we're going to mention Guam and stuff later, but
no,
to
really,
me, it's a debate.
Yeah, but you'll confuse people if you just put us all together that way. The difference between Guam, Puerto Rico, and the other territories is that they do not pay federal income taxes. And that really is a decisive difference between the nation's capital, the District of Columbia, and other places. Also, some have minuscule populations. Now, let's take Puerto Rico. It's got a big population, although many are fleeing because of climate change and the weather. But Puerto Rico is, the last time I looked, big enough to have six representatives. And the district is not so forbearing because it needs only one.
Also, let me point out, there's a great distinction. The land on which the District of Columbia sits was a part of the original United States of America. And Maryland and Virginia gave portions of their states, or then colonies, or to the federal government for the seat of government. Madison said because we had, in effect, given those citizens as well who lived on that property, that they were not going to lose their status as full United States citizens. So to that extent, the District of Columbia is very unique as opposed to Puerto Rico and the other territories.
It's interesting that you bring up the foundation of Washington, D.C. as previously land that belonged to Virginia and Maryland. And we'll get into this more. But of course, there are partisan implications for making Washington, D.C. a full state. And that would very likely mean two Democratic senators. You know, we can say that we don't want to forecast exactly how D.C. would vote, but looking at how it votes in election, which is about 90% in 2016.
I think it's a safe forecast.
Nate Silver says it's a safe forecast. Anyway, whether we want to talk about them or not, there are partisan implications that Republicans are very aware of when this conversation comes up. And so one of their responses to full statehood has been, you know, in the very early 1800s, D.C. gave the part of D.C. that belonged to Virginia back to Virginia. Could D.C. give the part of D.C. that used to belong to Maryland back to Maryland? You are a representative from Maryland, so this is a great question to ask you.
Well, I think it's a better question to ask the citizens of the District of Columbia because it ought to be their choice. We are a nation that believes in citizens having the choice. Puerto Rico, we've mentioned Puerto Rico. They have a choice. They can be an independent nation. They can be a state. Whether they're a commonwealth or not of the United States is really a decision of the United States. But having said that, frankly, I think that takes for granted that we can just push the residents of the District of Columbia wherever we want to place them. They really ought to have that choice. And they've made a clear choice. They've made a very clear choice that they want to be an independent, sovereign state of the Union. And in that context, that's what they ought to be.
Yeah, the choice has been made. People have gone to the polls. They were asked, do you want to become a state? And they voted overwhelmingly to become a state. You can't take a city which has acted in every way like a state, is treated even per capita distribution of federal funds like a state, and squeeze it into Maryland. Maryland has only one big city, that's Baltimore. You would change the entire character of the state of Maryland. No wonder Maryland would have to think twice. And of course, the district has thought more than twice. It wants to become a state.
What if, as a compromise, we merge the Dakotas together, put them back into one state because that was some gerrymandering in the first place, and you know, you could consolidate the number of states.
Okay. All
okay.
right.
Next.
I mentioned the partisan implications, and that is something that I want to get into because it is going to be an obstacle that Democrats will have to overcome. And also, it kind of raises questions about how important of an issue this is now. And when you listen to national Democrats and activists around the country, oftentimes on the left, they'll say, you know, we need to make structural changes in order to ensure that Democrats can pass their agenda on a federal level. And those structural changes could include statehood for D.C. and Puerto Rico. It could include, you know, abolishing the Electoral College. It could include packing the Supreme Court. You hear a lot of these big ideas kind of lumped together in terms of changes that people argue would make the country more democratic, but of course would also help Democrats pass their agenda on the federal level. How much of a role does that play in considerations now of making D.C. a state?
Well, it doesn't play any consideration now. It will ultimately play a consideration. Let's take the last two states to enter the Union, Alaska and Hawaii. They have flipped, easily flipped, being Democrat and Republican. The reason I bring that up is essentially the way in which states have gotten to the Union has been very partisan. Usually it takes a Democratic state and a Republican state. We're aware of that. We're aware of that. And when it comes to when we get closer to what you actually are going to do, we're going to have to figure out what you do. Meanwhile, the way in which the Congress of the United States works, it is one step at a time. Nobody says, okay, I guess I won't go for statehood until I find a corollary state. Things push other things to happen. And maybe by the time we get to statehood, it won't be one-to-one. But the first thing we have to do is to establish the foothold in the people's house. Then you go on to the next step.
Is that a bit of an acknowledgement, though, that you may have to admit, you know, a 52nd state along
it with is not. That it is no such thing.
South Utah.
It is no such thing. It tells you traditionally there has been some political equivalence. We have to take what we have done, you know, and the last time a state was in, it was more than 50 years ago, and say we're going to have to do exactly the same thing is not to ride with history. So we are going to have to deal with the fact that any big city, and yes, the District of Columbia is going to be largely Democratic. How do you cope with that equivalence? Well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Let me add, yes, that's obviously an issue, the partisanship. But very frankly, when Tom Davis was a member of Congress from the state of Virginia and was a leader in the Republican Party, Congresswoman Norton and I and Tom Davis worked together on legislation which would have at least given Eleanor Holmes Norton a full vote in the Congress of the United States. How? By adding an additional representative from Utah, which they were on the cusp of being eligible for and ultimately got. Very frankly, notwithstanding the fact that it was one for one, we didn't get
Although
that bill
it was
through.
It was a permanent one for a temporary one, right? Because there was no guarantee that having an extra representative in the next Congress after redistricting would help.
You're absolutely correct. And that's one of the reasons I've concluded that statehood is the option, because it would be, I think, tragic if we did what we do now. As majority leader back in 2006 or 2007, I offered to our rules package the ability of the representatives from the territories and from the District of Columbia to vote in the Committee of the Whole. And we could do that by legislation. And the Republicans, frankly, took us to court on that. And the court said, no, that was okay. We could do that. So that Eleanor had a vote in the – as she said, she votes. She votes in the Committee of the Whole. But when the Republicans took back control of the House in 2010 – they eliminated that vote, which I thought was a terrible lack of respect and democratic principles being extended to individuals who were representatives in the Congress of the United States. So the only way you can do it permanently and not have a subsequent Congress change it is to have statehood.
Yeah, but, but I must say, it was not temporary. There is no way in which Utah would ever have lost its state, its seat. You get a seat as you grow. And no, you couldn't very easily take away D.C.'s vote. We're talking about a House vote only then. So I do not agree it would have been temporary.
I guess the argument is that in the next round of apportionment, Utah would have gotten a new
– of
right. Utah would have gotten a
yeah,
new
but it would have gotten – it keeps
anyway.
Growing.
My point, though, that I think is important, it was one for one. So in that case, even then – we couldn't get it done.
No, well, wait a minute. But the reason wasn't one for one. The reason was the gun bill. Somebody attached a gun bill. We got it through the House. We got it through the Senate. Both houses voted to give D.C. a seat. But the National Rifle Association encouraged somebody to attach what we call a rider that would have eliminated all of the district's gun safety laws.
Let's continue this conversation in just a minute. But first, today's episode is brought to you by WeWork. From satellite offices to regional headquarters and global campuses, WeWork is designing, building, and operating office space that empowers your people to do their best work. WeWork's private offices come with state-of-the-art security features, dedicated reception areas branded to your business, large boardrooms reserved exclusively for your team, as well as soundproofed executive offices. Your team's safety and privacy is guaranteed throughout the workday and after hours. Today, we're in D.C., where WeWork has 12 locations across the metro area. Their newest location in Roslyn opened on Monday, with four more opening this year in DuPont Circle, downtown, and directly across from Union Station. All locations are metro accessible, and the best part is 11 of their 12 locations have stunning rooftop views, including the one where we're at today, which is 777 6th Street in Chinatown. In addition, uniquely curated programming, including networking events, happy hours, and panels, are tailored to your business's interests and designed to introduce your vision to the community and city at large. Members at WeWork's Washington, D.C. locations span across industries, including law, finance, advocacy, consulting, and the nonprofit sector. Head over to WeWork.com to learn more. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Finding a new job is a lot of work, but what if you had your own personal recruiter to help you find a better job? Now ZipRecruiter's technology can do that for you. Just download the ZipRecruiter job search app, let it know what kind of jobs you're interested in, and its technology starts doing the work. The ZipRecruiter app finds jobs you'll like and puts your profile in front of employers who may be looking for someone like you. If an employer likes your profile, ZipRecruiter lets you know, so if you're interested in the job, you can apply. No wonder ZipRecruiter is the number one rated job search app, and based on a third-party survey, 7 out of 10 people who found a new job on ZipRecruiter increased their salaries. Those were the results of a 2017 U.S. survey of over 500 ZipRecruiter users who got hired for a job they found on ZipRecruiter. Download the free ZipRecruiter job search app today and let the power of technology work for you. Don't wait. The sooner you download the free ZipRecruiter job search app, the sooner it can help you find a better job. Okay, let's continue the conversation. I want to get back to a question that I mentioned earlier, which is the structural questions at play in DC statehood. Do you see Democrats as having a structural disadvantage in the Senate that DC statehood could help alleviate?
Well, I think the answer to that is clearly we have a structural disadvantage in that essentially 18% of the population of some 22 states elect 50% of the United States Senate, because Democrats tend to be in urban and suburban areas. And so from that standpoint, it's a structural disadvantage and an anomaly really in our democracy when a relatively small percentage of the population elects the majority of the United States Senate, which is why we see it's so difficult to get agreement and passage. Whether that's going to be changed anytime soon, because that would need to be changed by constitutional amendment.
And well, of course, I guess I'm not talking about abolishing the Senate. More, do you think that creation of new states is a way to try to deal with the structural disadvantages that Democrats face in the Senate?
Well, of course it is. Depending upon what states you add and where they are.
Wait a minute.
Okay,
structural,
go ahead.
The fact is that, you know, the Democrats elected a president, President Obama, with that so-called structural disadvantage. You know, you could argue it the other way, that people are moving toward these mega centers, these centers dominated by cities and away from rural areas. You could argue that gives Democrats an advantage. We just have to go get the votes. We think we're going to get them in 2020. So I don't buy this unless something happens structurally in the states. Democrats can't win. And I think recent history shows that is not the case.
Oh, hold it. I hope, Eller, I didn't want to imply to any of our listeners that I thought that we couldn't win. We have won. And I think we're going to win in 2020. What I'm saying is what the structural system, as it now operates, a minority of the population can elect a majority of the Senate.
Yeah. Can you give us some context, Nate, for like when we talk about structural disadvantages for Democrats in the Senate, what specifically we're talking about?
I mean, I'm not just going to give you context, I'm going to give you a pithy little conclusion. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I think it's going to be very hard for Democrats to win the Senate, which does not mean impossible. They'll do it in their very best years with the 50 states as they are now, and the big conditional is if you have this big and increasing urban-rural divide. So right now, the average Senate seat is about 6 points more Republican than the country overall. So a 6-point edge is pretty large. And you can imagine if Democrats were to have a very good political climate for a few years, for example, last year they won the popular vote for the House by 8 or 9 points. If every Senate seat were up last year, then they might have won the Senate. But you saw what happened where you have a lot of these very partisan states where despite that very Democratic climate last year, they lost Senate seats in North Dakota, in Indiana,
Missouri.
Florida is a different case. Florida might be just a case of Bill Nelson having not been a great candidate. Florida is a purple state-ish. But it is an issue. And if hypothetically you were to add D.C. and Puerto Rico as states, that advantage would shrink from 6 points to 2 points, assuming that Puerto Rico and D.C. both voted Democratic. So again, there could be shifts where Democrats again start doing better in rural areas. You saw big growth for Democrats in the suburbs in 2018. And if that continues, the GOP will be in trouble in a lot of ways. But there are a lot of very rural states. There are a lot of states. I mean, I make this as a joke sometimes, right? But if you kind of go through and like look at like literally like randomly pick a name of a state, there are a lot of small states out west and to some extent in New England and so forth that do not have very large populations. They tend to be overwhelmingly white, by the way, which is another problem I would think potentially for representative democracy. So I do think it's a you never want to say permanent. It was in 2009 when Democrats had, what, 59 and then 60 after Specter switched Senate seats.
Nate, let me interject. We Democrats are not giving up hope nor objective of winning in rural areas. We think that, for instance, every American, wherever they live, is concerned about their health care. They're concerned about being precluded by pre-existing conditions. They're concerned about the cost of their pharmaceuticals, their drugs that they need for health and life and their families. So we think that many of the policies of this administration are hurting average working Americans who are struggling. We think that the policies are hurting farmers, for instance. Their trade policies are hurting farmers. So we think we're going to be very competitive in rural areas, and we're going to be contesting, as Eleanor pointed out, every area of this country. And we think the policies of this administration, as I said, are such that we're going to do well.
Do you see any other structural changes that could be made to address that structural disadvantage that Nate described?
That is not the way to look at American politics, to see if you can find what almost never happens, some kind of change in the structure of the way the country has operated often for most of its time. You got to look at other factors. For example, the Republicans are in bad shape now because they are not appealing to younger people. They are the party of old white men. You mentioned whites, Western states. What is it? Is it the governor, the Democratic governor of Montana, who's running for president?
Mm-hmm. Bullock.
So you got to see who votes for these people, as opposed to, hey, the real answer in our country is to look at structural change. Then nobody is going to get anywhere, because the Constitution, the framers formed this country to make structural change almost impossible. I mean, why do you think we have a president who can overturn what the entire House and Senate does? As far as they saw, this country, especially the federal government, should move very slowly. What has changed all that? It's not structural change. We have basically the same structure we had then. It's population change. It is political change.
In some ways, though, I mean, Republican strategy reflects the structures of American politics, where the fact that you can, in the Senate, kind of have governance by a minority of the population, in essence, and that you can have President Trump, maybe more pertinently, be elected by a minority of the country, not even a plurality, I should clarify. You know, his strategy of appealing to so-called white working class voters would not have worked if popular vote dictated the presidency in the U.S. or if for some fluke of the Constitution that urban states benefited more or something.
And so the question that, of course, stems from that I think some people in the party are asking right now is, do you pursue things like creating more states, trying to abolish the Electoral College, packing the Supreme Court, things like that? How do you guys
let me say how I feel
writ
about
large
it.
Those issues?
The only people even bring those things up are the 51 people, I think about now it's 22 or 23 people running for president, who are trying to outdo each other. So they come up with structural changes. They won't happen, but largely because they want to seem, you know, find some way, because they all agree on those things, to get out from each other. By focusing on structural change, you are looking at our country in a way that would mean we never had change. That is not how change happened in this country. Black people didn't get the right to vote in this country because of some structural change. So you have to ask yourself, well, how in the hell did you get it? How did you get the 64 Civil Rights Act? How did you get the 65 Voting Rights Act? How did you get the 68 Fair Housing Act? You got it because we finally, with the same structure in place, overwhelmed the Southern Democrats. So the notion that, hey, if you want to kind of change, you're after people, then go to the Constitution. We're not that hopeless.
I agree with Eleanor. We need to focus, as I said, on substance, on appealing to people where they live. And yes, some are in small states that are historically Republican. But President Obama didn't win two majority elections because there was structural change. He won two majority elections, one of the few presidents to do so in recent history, because he appealed to the interests of individuals wherever they lived. And I think that's what we have to do.
So getting back to the specifics of DC statehood, chart out for me what the process looks like in the coming years of making DC a state if the politics works out the way that you want it to.
We're following the path of most bills in the United States. Steny is the majority leader in the House. We don't pass bills in the House by saying, the way we will test this, members of the House, is to see whether we can pass that bill in the Senate. So the first thing you do, the way our country was designed, is you make sure you pass it in the House, and you plot your strategy House by House. We've just passed the DREAM Act, and it also would help others get citizenship. Now, that could not be more anathema to the Republicans. We are overjoyed to have passed it. That's going to appeal to a large section of the American public. So if you're interested in strategic politics in our country, you don't go two houses at a time. You'll work two houses at a time. But you make sure you are able to get your bill done in at least one house, because you will need, no matter what the bill is, an entirely different strategy for the other house.
Playing right off of that, I'll ask bluntly, is it worth doing away with the Senate filibuster to make D.C. a state?
That's not going to happen, but there is a group out called 51.
That won't happen.
51 for 51. We've gotten the filibuster is not been gotten away with, but it's become less and less important. There is a group that's supporting D.C. statehood called 51 for 51, which is arguing that because it is the nation's capital, it ought to be done with 51. We don't think that's going to happen. We also don't think that the Senate, and you will find people, by the way, Democrats and Republicans, wanting to hold on to the filibuster. So I'm not counting, once you again, you're going to structural change, not to how the country has always operated, you know, and to how we've won.
We have a strong intellectual argument. First of all, we're going to do like we do with every bill. There'll be a hearing in the Government Reform Committee, of which Ms. Norton is a leading member, one of the senior members of the House of Representatives. I think it's going to be passed out of that with a favorable report to the House. I'm going to put it on the floor. We're going to vote on it. I think it will pass the House. And then it'll go to the Senate. And the intellectual argument that you're going to make, which is pretty strong, you have about 500,000 Wyoming American citizens. You have 700,000 District of Columbia American citizens. Why should they be treated differently in a country that talks about equality and justice and inclusion? And I think so you can make a strong intellectual argument. I think I agree with Eleanor. The structural change would be tough to get to. But I think we have a very strong intellectual argument that and maybe a legal argument that every citizen ought to be treated with due process and equally. But
is there a lawsuit to be? I guess I haven't heard of that discussed much. Is there a lawsuit to be filed?
It just occurs to me that an equal protection argument might be made of the citizen of Wyoming being treated a lot better than the District of Columbia and a lot better than the citizens of California. But the fact of the matter is we have a strong intellectual argument to make. And I hope we make that argument. And I hope that we win more members of the United States Senate on the Democratic side. But I also hope that we convert some Republicans to the cause of treating District of Columbia citizens in an equal way and giving them votes in the Senate and the House.
I mean, tactically, I can see why Representative Norton is skeptical about having Puerto Rico be part of this discussion, because they are very different cases. They're very different cases. But tactically, we know that the average American appears to be more sympathetic for Puerto Rico than D.C., so why not lump them together?
Well, lumping them together doesn't get you anything in terms of the partisan argument, which is your point.
Well, I guess, you know, statehood for Puerto Rico is part of the Republican platform.
Please, would you get that in, that the representative, even the delegate from Puerto Rico, is a Republican, and I think that is reflected. That is not reflected in the population. however. You will find that Puerto Ricans have much more in common and tend to be Democrats, but somehow they're structured so their delegate is often a Republican.
But couldn't that be the one-for-one trade, right?
Well, look, I'm a very strong supporter and have been for over a quarter of a century of statehood for Puerto Rico. I think that the citizens of Puerto Rico, however, need to make that decision. Unlike the District of Columbia, they have not, which very dispositively said, we want to be a state. Puerto Rico has been a little more complex. And while I think the citizens of Puerto Rico, clearly the majority of them are for being a state, that's my own personal belief.
And, Dade, I must say, when we've been talking here, we're not talking about anybody winning or losing anything. So you really got to put in your equation that Puerto Ricans would have to pay federal income taxes. That's losing something that they don't have now. They get almost everything that the states get, not quite everything, but they don't pay federal income taxes.
My view is once the citizens of Puerto Rico make it very clear they want to be a state, we ought to admit them as a state. We are not a colonial power. We don't want to be a colonial power. We should not be a colonial power. So Puerto Rico, which has 3.6 million people, they've shrunk a little bit since the hurricane. A lot of them have moved to Florida and now voting in Florida, but other jurisdictions as well. And so the District of Columbia stands on its own merit, and Puerto Ricans ought to stand on their own merit. All I'm saying, it's not a deal because from your standpoint, the Republicans will look at it as two Democratic jurisdictions. As Eleanor pointed out earlier, when Alaska and Hawaii were admitted, Alaska was expected to be the Democratic state and Hawaii the Republican state. But Hawaii is now the Democratic state and Alaska is the Republican state. So Eleanor's point that she made earlier is, you know, you focus on that and then you find out history doesn't prove you to be right.
Right. And to your point about what Puerto Ricans want, the polling and the results of the referenda there are not as clear cut as the polling
Correct.
And the results of the referendum in Washington, D.C., which was 85% in support.
Well, Puerto Ricans themselves don't agree on whether it should be a commonwealth, whether it should be a state. I mean, they haven't settled that matter internally. You don't have that issue with the District of Columbia.
That was my point. Mm-hmm. But I would say on behalf of Puerto Rican statehood, 97% of the people that voted, it's just that the Commonwealth and others did not vote in the election. But so there were only 20-some-odd percent that voted. But very frankly, we have a lot of elections in this country on the mainland where you have 20-25% of the vote, and the outcome is honored.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much, Congresswoman Norton.
Can I just say, Congresswoman Norton – has done an extraordinary job in making sure this issue has been front and center, been on the table. And as I say, I've had the honor of working with her for a very long period of time to make sure that the citizens of the District of Columbia are respected, notwithstanding the fact that Congress constantly wants to override what decisions they make inappropriately. And now we have the opportunity to say to these 700,000 U.S. citizens, you're larger than a number of states. You're entitled to a full voting representation in your Congress, and we're going to give you that.
And the vote is going to occur on July 24th. That would bring this bill to the floor of the House of Representatives. That'll be a vote in committee.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Congresswoman Norton. Thank you, Congressman Hoyer.
Thank you.
And thanks to WeWork for setting us up with the space here in D.C. to record today's podcast. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is on the audio controls. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.